This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Destroyer of Worlds, Saga of the Forgotten Warrior, written by Larry Correa, performed by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Maps found in the print edition of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click on the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Thank you.
Chapter 1. 19 years ago. One was 16 years old, the other only 12. They were best friends, brothers, but not by blood. In a moment they would duel. More than likely, one of them would die.
"I beg you, Devidas, do not go through with this.
Can't you see? I've got no choice, Ashok," the older of them shouted.
"I have to try."
Bound by law and tradition, Ashok couldn't walk away either. As the chosen bearer of mighty Angruvadal, he was obligated to accept all challengers, just in case the powerful ancestor blade might find someone more worthy to wield it. How could Angruvadal not choose Devadas over him? Devadas was the best of them, stronger, smarter, and more dedicated than any of the other acolytes. He had climbed to the top of the Protector's brutal program. Officially, all were equal in status, but Devadas was the son of a Thakur and had been raised expecting to someday rule a great house. He was superior to Ashok in every way but one. Ashok had Angruvadal. The mighty black steel blade of Great House Vadal had been kept from him the entire time he had been in training. The master would allow Ashok no magical edge over the other boys, so Angruvadal had been taken away. A normal man could not understand what it was like to be a bearer. It wasn't just his sword that had been lost, but it was as if part of himself had been locked away in that cold vault. For 2 long years he had suffered incomplete. Except now, their trial was past. They had crossed glaciers and fought ancient automatons. All the others had turned back as failures. 3 had pressed on. Yugantar had given in to fear and fled. He was certainly dead now, his body frozen up there forever. Only Ashok and Devadas had fought on. They had reached the highest peak and touched the heart of the mountain. Ashok was the youngest to ever do so in the entire history of the Order. They were no longer acolytes, but full members of the Protector Order, with all its accompanying status, privilege, and responsibilities. It was one of the greatest achievements a law-abiding man could ever hope for, yet the joy he had felt at attaining senior rank was nothing compared to getting his sword back. The normally dour masters had allowed their trainees to freely celebrate the advancement of 2 of their own, or to mourn the one they'd lost. All the acolytes, even the failures, were allowed all the meat and wine they desired. A rare treat indeed. Except their celebration had quickly turned ugly. It was plain that bitterness had consumed Devadas when he had seen the legendary Angruvadal riding upon its bearer's hip. He'd claimed it was unfair that Ashok should have such an honor and not him. When the ancestor blade of Great House Dev had shattered in his father's hands, it had taken with it his inheritance and all his family's dignity. Ashok had tried to deflect, to once again say that it was not his choice to make, but the sword. Only Devadas had grown increasingly jealous as the night went on. Though they'd trained together, fought together, undertaken the trial together, and nearly died upon the mountain together, none of that mattered in the moment, because Devadas's one weakness was his pride. Accusations had been made. Youthful foolishness had led to anger. Ashok had tried to turn aside his brother's wrath. They were both tired. It had been a long journey down the mountain, Only Devadas had not relented. He had goaded Ashok to this point. Words had been spoken which could not be retracted.
"You are the closest friend I've ever had," Ashok told him truthfully. "Please do not make me kill you."
As the son of a bearer, Devadas understood the rules. A duel to see if a challenger was worthy to claim an ancestor blade did not need to be to the death, but it often was, because by their very nature, black steel blades were very unforgiving.
"Better to try and fail than be a coward and never know."
The two stood in the middle of the practice field, dusted white with snow, surrounded by a circle of nervous protectors, young and old, from the most recently obligated acolyte to 20-year-old senior Mindarin, who had been one of their instructors. That most experienced protector was furious.
"You should stop this foolishness at once. The order is too small in number as it is. You're both valuable assets, better spent in defense of the law. However a duel ends, the order will be weaker for it." "Do you order me to stand down?" Devadas asked.
Mindarin shook his head.
"You know I cannot. Your actions, though wasteful and stupid, are entirely legal. The bearer cannot deny you, and the challenger cannot be denied."
"Forgive me, honored teacher, for you know what I must do."
It obviously pained Devadas to disappoint Mindarin, because he had been the acolyte's kindest instructor, teaching by word and example, which was much preferred by all of them to Master Ratul's methods, which consisted of beatings and hunger. A man of reason rather than passion, Mindarin had not given up so easily.
"Listen to me, Devadas. Your father is dead. Your house has fallen. Claiming a new sword will not bring either back. Let them go. Your life has been obligated to the order. This is your family now."
He gestured at the acolytes, who were anxiously watching to see which of their friends would die.
"You know I love them and the order both.
Yet you cannot be fully committed until you put the order first. Great House Dev is no more. You were my best student. Yet the one lesson I could never get to stick with you is that you cannot reclaim old glories. Sometimes the past is best forgotten."
Ashok found that to be a curious sentiment, coming from the protector who had been responsible for teaching them about history. The approved parts of history, at least.
"I respect your wisdom, Mindarin, but I can't accept it. I was raised to be the Thakur of a great house, with a black steel blade as my birthright."
"What's done is done, young Devadas."
Devadas met Ashok's gaze and gave him a sad smile.
"I have to try." "So be it then. I wash my hands of this, and Gruvadal will decide which one of you to deprive the order of." "Karno! Summon the master!"
Mindarin snapped at one of the youngest acolytes, who immediately ran off to warn Ratul that his two newest senior ranks were about to kill each other. The two of them squared off, 10 paces between them. The circle of protectors backed up to give them space, for even the ones who had not seen an ancestor blade in action knew of their deadly reputation. It was not unheard of for one of the angry things to remove the limb from a curious bystander. Ashok found it very lonely inside the circle. The crowd did not cheer for either of them. There were no favorites here. A natural leader who honestly cared for the well-being of the other acolytes, Devadas was beloved by all. Ashok had been seen as a young upstart at first, because he had arrived already gifted with one of the most powerful artifacts in the world. Except he had gone on to win their respect by being the most dedicated among them. He tried one last time to get his brother to see reason.
"The law requires me to do my best. I will hold nothing back."
It was a grave warning. For though they had sparred against each other hundreds of times now, and Devadas, being bigger, stronger, and faster, almost always won, those victories were against Ashok alone. When you fought a bearer, you fought against the combined instinct of every man who had ever carried that sword into battle. A part of each of its prior bearers lived on in the black steel, as would a fragment of Ashok, as long as Angruvadal survived. It was one of the only forms of immortality in a world where the law declared there was no existence beyond this life.
Everyone knows you always do precisely what the law says, little brother.
Devadas gave him a sad smile. It's why it's impossible to hate you. Ashok could not feel fear like everyone else, but he could understand it well enough in principle. He could see that Devadas was afraid, as any sane man would be to face an ancestor blade, yet he was committed.
Know that if it was my decision, I would do my best to defeat you, but I would try to spare your life. Only I do not think Angruvadal understands moderation.
Devadas simply nodded. It was good that he was willing to accept death. Ashok suspected that such acceptance was necessary in order to win Angruvadal's approval. Ashok did not want to die. But if he did, at least this way Angruvadal would have a worthy new bearer.
Offense has been taken, Devadas shouted so that all could hear the official challenge. Offense has been given.
Ashok did not think it had, but tradition demanded he accept. The duel began, not in a sudden burst of movement, but in absolute stillness. The opponents watched each other, waiting. Then Devadas shifted his weight ever so slightly, boots crunching into the snow and gravel beneath. His strong hand moved slowly until it was poised just over the hilt of his sword. Ashok's hand hovered over Angruvadal. It had been 2 years since he had drawn the sword, but ancestor blades never lost their edge. Black steel did not rust. It was alive and hungry. He could feel the hum of angry energy prickling through his palm. The sword wanted to know who needed to be killed.
Please have mercy on him, Angruvadal. I think this one will accomplish great things for the law.
Ashok tried his best to make his will known to his sword, but it remained a mystery if Angruvadal understood or cared.
And he is my friend.
There was some movement at the edge of the circle. As if from a great distance, he heard someone say that Master Ratul had arrived. But Ashok's focus was entirely upon the duel. It was cold. Thick blood made for slow hands. The wind blew. A little eddy of snow swirled between them. Devadas's finger twitched. Soon. Another involuntary twitch. 40 generations of bearers were with Ashok. They knew exactly what would happen. They'd seen the gathering of strength, the tensing of muscle, and the sudden explosive movements thousands of times. And all of that instinct was there for the taking. It was as if there were ghosts in the black steel, always whispering. Though legally his to use, such an advantage seemed dishonorable. If his brother was willing to die in order to test his commitment, then so was Ashok.
No, Angruvadal. I will do this myself.
The whispers stopped. There was only the wind and the weight. Ashok thought of nothing. There would be only action and reaction. Devadas moved. Eye-searing Angruvadal was in Ashok's hand, so fast it was like he'd willed the black steel into being. They struck at the same time. They had the same swordmaster, which was more important than them having different fathers. There were names for the stances and techniques they used, but in the instant they simply were. It was the purest moment of Ashok's life. There was a flash of black as the two opponents crossed. Anyone else in the world and Devadas surely would have been the victor. Except Angruvadal would not be choosing a new bearer tonight. Ashok swept past Devadas, sword still rising past the cut. He saw the look on his other brothers' faces, awestruck, for they'd never seen any living thing move that fast. Protector Mindarin gaped in surprise, but Master Ratul just watched him, bemused, something calculating and cruel in his dark eyes. As Devadas fell, the normal world came rushing back. His opponent was down. Ashok realized the others wanted to rush and help their fallen, but they didn't dare step into the circle as long as Fearsome Angruvadal was free. Offense had been claimed. Ashok was within his legal rights to finish his challenger, but the law was wise. Allowed was not mandatory. He looked at Angruvadal. It was somehow clean of blood, as if Angruvadal was too proud to be stained. He thanked his sword, then sheathed it, declaring the conflict over. Ratul nodded, and that was all the instruction the acolytes needed to run over to injured Devadas. Ashok followed them. There was blood all over the snow. Devadas's handsome face had been sliced wide open from his chin to his right eye. Luckily, the eye was still in one piece, though the pain had to be terrible, and black steel wounds were said to burn like the sun. Devadas did not scream. Instead, he ground his teeth together. Ashok could tell because they were visible through the hole in his cheek. And the only sound that escaped was the pained growl of a wounded animal. Yet Ashok could see the terrible agony in his brother's eyes. Not of the lacerated flesh alone, no. For though Angruvadal had spared his life, it had killed his dreams. Ashok had no dreams, only duty. Now, he supposed, they were the same. It was a good thing they had just completed their trial and touched the heart of the mountain, for its healing magic would save Devadas. Otherwise, a wound like that would probably become infected and be the death of a normal man. The magic they had in their blood now would help him heal. Ashok was thankful for that.
Lucky for you, Angruvadal was in a kind mood and didn't remove your fool head from your stiff neck, Lord Protector Ratul said as he walked over to assess the terrible injury. He looked down at all the blood and sighed.
I swear your ambition is going to be the death of me someday, Devadas. I hope you learned a valuable lesson today.
Eyes wide and filled with agony, Devadas managed to nod his head yes.
Good. Carry him to the surgeon.
But Devadas surprised even the master as he shoved the helping hands away and struggled up under his own power. Even though there was a dangling gap through the side of his face, he managed to say something that sounded like,
I'll make it myself.
Indeed, Ratul muttered so low that only nearby Ashok could hear. So that's the lesson you choose to learn. Ashok had never felt more alive, and he owed that to Devadas.
I am honored to call you my brother.
And according to the traditions of the great House Vidal, Ashok gave the deepest, most respectful bow possible, exposing the back of his neck as a sign of trust, and held it a long time as a show of admiration. When he raised his eyes, Devadas was staggering away, leaving behind a red trail of footprints in the snow. Chapter 2. 90 days had passed since the Capitol had ordered the warrior caste to study the feasibility of killing every untouchable in the world. This time, they were not speaking of mere population control, nor the traditional method of warning and punishment, but rather the complete eradication of the casteless bloodline. Every last non-person in Locke, young and old, male and female, starved, burned, thrown in the sea, or put to the sword. A morbid totality. The warrior's report had been delivered to the Chamber of Argument that very morning. The representative of their caste had just finished testifying before the assembled judges that this task would not be nearly as difficult as some had claimed, and that it could be completed within a year, with the majority dead within one season. The judges were assured the Great Extermination would be a simple affair. Grand Inquisitor Ormond Vaucan knew there would be nothing simple about it. Most likely, wars would rage, millions would die, and houses would fall. However, this was the capital, where truth was not as important as leverage, and reality became a malleable narrative. It had actually been impressive how his hand-picked warrior had been able to deliver the absurdly optimistic report with a straight face. In reality, the Great Extermination would be a violent, bloody mess that would drag on for years and crack the very foundations of the law. Excellent. Through blackmail, intimidation and bribery, Ormond had made certain that the report said exactly what he wanted it to say. He'd cowed the warriors' representatives as easily as the archivists' and historians' orders before them. All the information given to the decision-makers had thus far been perfectly tooled to tell the story Ormond wanted told. The judges were too soft, too removed, too aloof to realize just how ignorant they really were about the true nature of the world. To them, the castless were some nebulous numbers on a ledger, not beings of flesh and blood who would fight to preserve their lives, no matter how pathetic those lives may be. From behind his golden mask, Ormond watched the judges carefully as the session resumed. Even as skilled at debate as these men were, they couldn't hide their emotions. Many realized they were now seriously discussing the systematic slaughtering of the dregs of their society. Some of the judges were soft enough to think of the castless as people. Not that they would dare say something so outlandish, but their revulsion was plain. Many others understood perfectly well what was being proposed, and the idea of being free of the flea-ridden garbage who haunted the worst slums of their homelands was an appealing one. Some were oblivious, for to them the castless were little more than dangerous, dirty livestock. A few were afraid of the economic ramifications, because the poorer houses needed their labour to survive. Not that they would say so here, because to do so would be a shameful embarrassment. A handful of judges, though, whether they gave a damn about castless lives or not, from their clenched jaws and narrowed eyes, they knew exactly what was afoot, and they would not be played. They were his competition in the great game. Ormond noted each of his final obstacles. The problematic judges would be dealt with individually. He could bend some to his will, break those who would not bend, and remove those who would not break. It wouldn't take long for him to have the majority. He would win eventually, because to these men this was just another heated political issue of many, but for Armand it was the culmination of his life's work. There was nothing he would not do, including consort with demons or destroy the law itself, to get what he wanted. A handful of the judges may have been adamantly opposed to genocide for whatever reason, but most didn't understand the rules or the stakes of this game, and none of them knew who their real opponent was. As a mere servant of the law, Armand had no vote here. Officially, the Order of Inquisition offered no opinion in the creation of the law. They simply did the unsavory work necessary to maintain it once passed. The Grand Inquisitor may have been a terrifying spectre, but he was a quiet one. Armand merely observed. He rarely spoke during these events, and then only when called upon by his supposed betters. That didn't mean that he did not have allies to speak for him. Senior Arbiter Artia Zati Darzagar took her place at the podium.
I would like to thank our honorable warriors for the tremendous effort you took to conduct such a thorough investigation. I have no doubt that once our wise judges make the right decision concerning this issue, your brave caste will have very little difficulty eradicating these vermin.
The few representatives of the warrior caste allowed into the illustrious chamber sat there stone-faced, revealing nothing. Except for Armand's puppet warrior, who accepted the praise with a smile. The poor fool actually thought he would benefit from his lies once this was all over. Armand figured once everything went to pieces, the judges would need someone to blame. Better some nobody warrior than the important man pulling his strings. Artia was a woman of notable attractiveness and rapidly increasing status. Charming, elegant, and a supremely gifted orator, the young lady had become the public face of those in favor of the great extermination. The play that she had produced about Ashok Vidal's violent crimes against the first caste had done much to sway opinion in the capital. Armand had secretly paid for the entire production, but the people did not need to know that. As Artia launched into another impassioned speech about the casteless menace, no one interrupted her. Normally, the Chamber of Argument lived up to its name. The judges were normally a verbally combative lot, but in the current climate, no one wanted to be seen as soft on the issue. The many massacres that had been recently committed by untouchables, or by Armand's agents in their name, had robbed the non-people of their regular defenders. Normally, some fool would give some teary-eyed speech about the value of mercy, but even those pathetic wretches kept their mouths shut today. At the end of Archer's speech would be presented a proposal. It would seem an innocuous enough request to the judges. Little would they realize that it would begin a chain of events which could lead to the bloodiest conflagration since the revolution that had ended the Age of Kings and brought about the Age of Law. He already knew how this vote would turn out. The only judge he'd been worried would be shrewd enough to figure out the ramifications of Archer's proposal wasn't present. Armand had arranged a crisis which had required Harta Vidal's personal attention, so he was currently journeying north. The Vidal representative left in his place was not nearly as astute as Harta. Even though Great House Vidal had been weakened by the loss of their ancestor blade and shamed by the revelation that their greatest hero had been a casteless fraud, they remained wealthy enough to sway many votes. The Chamber of Argument was a stunning place, improved upon over hundreds of years by the finest artisans the great houses could provide. It was odd that something so appealing to the eye could be so dead of heart. It was a vast space, filled with seats, and in each
sat someone of great status and importance, blissfully unaware that they were about to vote to cause a crisis which would leave a great many of them ruined or dead. Ormond found the whole thing fascinating. I know that many reasonable concerns have been raised. This is understandable. Though the Castless have troubled us for centuries, the archivists have confirmed that there is no legal reason we must continue to endure their awfulness. The warriors have just told us that removing them is doable. Other reports have been commissioned to look at the economic ramifications to each house, which is exceedingly wise and prudent. And that was when Artia asked for her one small thing. But in the meantime, I would like to propose a practical exercise, a feasibility study, if you will.
What do you mean, Arbiter? The chief judge asked.
During the time we have debated this topic, rebellion has spread over much of the great House Akershan and spilled into several other houses. While we have talked, towns have been put to the torch, industries have been ruined. These rebels have specifically targeted our caste, killing men, women, and children of the first.
Enough. We all know of these crimes. Specify your proposal.
I propose that in one small part of the region afflicted by rebellion, the casteless populations be eliminated entirely. Let us pick some provinces that we have been unable to pacify. Turn loose the full might of the warrior caste in just those few, not just upon the lawbreakers, but upon those who harbour and hide them. Destroy all the casteless quarters and kill these exceedingly disobedient wretches, as they would do to us if given the chance. I propose that the Inquisition be tasked to observe this righteous correction, so that the rest of the houses can learn from the experience, and our judges will be able to make a more enlightened decision about what to do with the rest.
Another judge, who was also a secret member of Oman's dark councils, stood.
I am Faril Akarshan. I second her proposal. My house will gladly volunteer the Upper Arkara, the Darvan Bench, and the North Chakma Plains for this test.
Faril had not been told why of his house's many holdings Ormond had requested those in particular, but since each of them was currently unprofitable, he had given them up without complaint. Ormond did not choose randomly. The first two were hotbeds of rebellion, where the non-people were certain to react violently. The last province was the most important, for Chakma was not too far from the last place Ashok Vidal had been seen. If the Black Heart had survived the destruction of the Lost House, then surely a slaughter of this magnitude would draw him from his hiding place. Ideally, he'd have the real Ashok striking terror into the heart of the capital again. But if not, he'd simply hire one of the surviving members of the House of Assassins, now impoverished and desperate, to act Ashok's part. But vengeful Ashok would be so much better than any impostor. The chief judge banged his staff on the floor.
The motion has been seconded.
The judges exchanged glances. It seemed simple enough. It was three unimportant provinces in one of the poorest great houses on the far side of the continent, a long way from here. Ormond knew how this would go because in their own way, the highest status judges were as predictable as the no-status castless. They would leave feeling like they'd accomplished something while postponing facing the real problem. And it required absolutely no effort or discomfort on their part. Of course the proposal passed. No one bothered to argue against it. With the death sentence handed down, the chamber was dismissed for lunch. He had been so confident the vote would proceed as expected that Amand had already arranged for these new orders to be relayed immediately by magic. Such instantaneous communications used up whole pieces of valuable demon bone, but it was worth the expense to satisfy his excitement. This way, the Akashani warriors could mobilize immediately. In a way, this triumph was bittersweet. History had just been made, but he was the only one who realized it. The great extermination had begun.
Chapter 3. Lord Protector Devadas had crossed the frozen mountains to find the plains on fire. It had been a long journey from the central desert, and they'd been caught in a brutal winter storm along the way. The cold had killed their horses, but it had only inconvenienced their riders. It took more than weather to stop a protector. His men had been miserable, but too proud to ever let it show. The other protectors had been unlucky enough to be born northerners, where the sun always shined and the air didn't cut your face. So the journey had been harder on them than it had been for Devadas. Though they'd come from the soft lands of green grass and silk, each of them had still survived the Order's brutal program, training in the Hall of Protectors, high in the unforgiving mountains of Dev. So they had simply gritted their teeth, called upon the heart to keep their extremities from becoming frostbitten, and marched on. His companions had only trained in Dev. He had been born there. It had made him. His home had been slick rocks covered in treacherous snow and ice crevices where one misplaced boot meant they'd never find your body, where giant predatory bears, so white they might as well be invisible, lurked in wait. He'd lived beneath a volcano that routinely belched fire and molten rock and drank sulphurous water that had gushed out of the ground steaming hot. On the southern coast, it occasionally got cold enough to freeze the air in your lungs, turning it sharp as daggers so you'd cough up blood or drown in it. This crossing had been pleasant in comparison. The snowstorm had slowed them, but a small band of protectors had pushed through the Thau passes and then marched south into Akashan lands. Somewhere in the vast area of this great house was hidden the headquarters of the Castless Rebellion, and Devadas suspected that was where they would catch their former brother, Ashok Vidal. Ashok's fall had brought dishonor to them all, and he had murdered one of their own in Nirampon several months ago. No one in the Order would rest until Ashok had been put down like the rabid dog he'd become. After the traitor was slain and his shame erased from the world, then Devadas intended to return to the capital to be hailed as the hero who had stopped the most infamous criminal in generations. It was illegal for a member of the Order to seek personal glory, but the rest of the protectors didn't know what Devadas knew. There was a conspiracy among the powerful men of the capital to overthrow the judges, a terrible crime. Yet he had agreed to look the other way. The judges deserved to be cast down. A mighty change was upon them, and before it was through, Devadas intended to be crowned king. All he had to do was find and kill his best friend first. His protectors had claimed new horses, tack, and supplies in the first settlement they'd come across. It was a poor place, and what they took would cause great hardship to the worker caste there, but none dared argue with the demands of four servants of the law. Riding was better than walking, and his men had breathed sighs of relief as it was all downhill from there. They had been riding along the banks of the Akara River for 2 days when they saw the plume of smoke. Akashan was notorious for having wildfires that could stretch for miles, but there was still snow on the ground, so it was unlikely that this was natural. Plus, in the 2 decades he'd served the law, Devadas had put many buildings to the torch, and the smoke always had a certain colour
when it was someone's home that was burning. From the amount, several structures were on fire, perhaps even a whole village.
"Let us investigate," Devadas told his men.
"Hopefully, it's the rebels attacking again."
Abhishek Gujara was obviously excited at the prospect of a fight. They'd endured weeks of hard travel, hunger, and discomfort, so a good battle against lawbreakers would certainly cheer them all up. Protectors could be a grim bunch, but they never lacked for enthusiasm when it came to applying their trade.
"If we're lucky, they'll be led by the Blackheart himself,"
Jamari Vidal stated flatly.
"And we can get this over with."
They pushed their horses hard, but these were herding mounts, not used to carrying men in armor. It took them a while to get close enough to ascertain the cause of the smoke. It was a settlement of maybe 300 people in total. Only a handful of homes belonging to the higher status members of the worker caste were made of wood. The rest were tent homes, common to these lands, round to survive the constant winds, with walls made of hide or grey felt. Most of those were untouched. However, across a small stream was a separate, smaller living area, crowded and muddy, and currently entirely aflame. Devadas slowed his horse to a walk so he could better assess the situation. The others followed his example. He used the heart to sharpen his vision until distant things became clear. There was at least a full paltron of 50 warriors there. The banner they were flying consisted of vertical green stripes on a tan flag. The symbol of Great House Akushan was supposed to represent the grass on the plains, or some such nonsense. Devadas had always struggled to pay attention during Master Mindaran's lessons on heraldry.
"They are burning that castless quarter," Abhishek muttered. "I wonder why."
"It's their house's property to do with as they wish, so it's none of our concern. But if it's because they've been caught aiding the rebels, I want one alive to interrogate."
Devadas thumped his horse with his heels and forced it into an awkward gallop. Surprisingly, these castless were fighting back, and from the looks of it, had achieved a tiny, albeit temporary, bit of success. The warriors must have been surprised to meet actual resistance, but they were warriors, and castless were castless, so it appeared to have quickly turned into a massacre. There were a couple obviously dead warriors lying in the mud, but for every dead warrior there were 10 dead castless. Their rough weapons, mostly repurposed farm tools, were still in their hands. But there were still a few splintered spears and stolen swords among them, and it was illegal for the non-people to possess arms. So it was the rebellion, then. Serves them right. There were still pockets of resistance between the burning tents, but the warriors appeared to have the matter well in hand.
"Who is in command here?" Devadas shouted.
The warriors had been so focused on their mission that they'd not heard the protectors approach. Several of them immediately pointed toward where their flag had been planted into a pile of straw. The Rizaldar in charge of the butchery seemed shocked to see silver-armored protectors riding up to him. One of the mightiest enforcers of the law was a rare sight. Four was unheard of.
"I am." And then the officer saw that Devadas wasn't just wearing the fanged visage of the law on his chest, but also the special insignia that marked him as the head of that entire fearsome order. The color drained from his face as he meekly asked,
"How may I serve, Lord Protector?"
Since Devadas held the power to declare almost anyone in the world a violator of the law and then immediately carry out their sentence, he was used to such reactions. It was good this Rizaldar knew his place.
"What's going on here?"
"Orders direct from the capital to our Thakur earlier this week. We're to put all the castlers here to the sword."
From the looks of things, they were being rather thorough about it. Non-people were being struck down left and right. Spears were thrust into fallen bodies to make sure they weren't just faking. A few non-people were crying and begging for mercy, swearing that they weren't aiding the rebels, but not too far away could still be heard the sounds of battle, proving them liars. If they weren't rebels, they were at least collaborators.
Odd. Why would the capital even know or care about this one village?
My apologies, Lord Protector. I didn't speak clear enough. It's not just these here, but all of them. Every quarter across the north, from Akara to the eastern Nansaka, is to be burned. We're to spare none of them.
As Devadas watched, a castless child ran from one of the burning tents, but a warrior caught her by the hair and hurled her screaming back into the fire.
Every single untouchable? Not just those who are rebelling? This is the third quarter we've struck in 2 days. The first two didn't even know what was happening until it was over.
The Rizaldar seemed haunted as he said that. This certainly wasn't the glorious battle that young warriors dreamed of, that was for sure.
I know they're not really people, and the law has spoken, but...
Then he realized he was on the verge of saying something that could be construed as subversive, and stopped.
The capital's request will be carried out expediently, I assure you.
That's a vast area. There has to be a multitude of castles there.
Tens of thousands, Lord Protector. Here.
The officer reached into his uniform and pulled out a folded letter.
So you know I speak the truth.
Saddle creaking, Devadas leaned over to take the orders. At some point, the Rizaldar had left bloody fingerprints on the paper, now dried. He read carefully. The order was legitimate, lawful, and stamped by a senior arbiter. His horse began to shake nervously beneath him, nostrils flaring as the thick smell of burning flesh and hair reached them.
It'll get more difficult as we go. Word has spread that we're coming, so they'll go into hiding, or be like these fools and actively try to stand and fight. I don't know if the capital understands. There are a lot more non-people in this province than there are warriors.
The Order of Census and Taxation surely knew the exact population down to the last castless and goat, which meant the judges knew and simply did not care. Trying to kill all the castless was madness. Previously, he'd made the mistake of voicing his disgust in the chamber of argument as the clueless weaklings and sheltered fops had debated such a bloody scheme. If Armand wanted a crisis sufficient to shake the capital, he was about to get one.
You have the law on your side,
Devadas said as he handed the letter back. I'm sure your Thakor will give you whatever support you need. Devadas turned back to look at his men. The youngest among them was Abhishek, but even he was a 5-year senior. None of them were strangers to this kind of grisly business. They might not be as unfeeling about carrying out their darker duties as black-hearted Ashok had been, but the law required protectors who would do what was necessary, and not flinch. If any of them objected to what was happening here, they were careful not to show it. There was a sudden loud noise, like a crack of thunder. It made Devadas's poorly trained horse rear back, frightened. As he got the beast under control, he demanded,
"What was that?" "I don't know," the Rizaldar said. "Excuse me, I must see to my men."
The sound had come from inside the flaming castless quarter. Two warriors came running out, dragging a third between them. That one was dangling limp, with a small wound on his back and drizzling blood from a gaping hole in his chest. Whatever had struck him had punched a hole through his armor, front and back, and clean through his torso. They were carrying him to aid, but as the protectors watched them go by, it was obvious that nothing would be able to save him.
"Curious," said Abhishek.
Right before his head exploded. Blood hit Devadas in the eyes as the sound of thunder washed over them. Abhishek toppled from the saddle as his horse bolted. Devadas's horse nearly threw him as well, but moving faster than any normal man could, he was able to dismount and jump aside to land smoothly. Perplexed, Devadas wiped the blood from his face with one hand. Abhishek was lying in the mud. The top of the young protector's skull was split open as if it had been hit with a war hammer. Bone and brain were visible to the light of day and spread upon the ground. His eyes were open and staring. Even with the heart of the mountain to sustain their lives through terrible injuries, that blow had been so sudden, so devastating, that death had been instantaneous.
"What manner of witchcraft is this?"
shouted Jamari as he ran to Abhishek's side.
"Fortress magic," Devadas snarled as he threw his sword.
"Find the wizard!"
He ran in the direction the thunder had come from, leapt high over a burning tent, and landed on the other side in a clank of steel and rattle of chain. He moved through the swirling smoke, searching. Bits of burning felt were drifting into the sky. Then he saw a figure holding a strange device, still shrouded in a grey haze. Since warriors were running from him, that had to be the wizard. Furious, Devadas shoved the terrified soldiers out of his way. But the wizard's deadly magic had caused the castlers to rally. One of them charged him with a pitchfork. Devadas kicked the tines aside, slashed the thigh to the bone, and kept moving. Another threw a hatchet at him. Devadas caught it and hurled it right back, striking the castlers in the throat. He collapsed with a gurgle. The wizard was wrestling with his strange device. It was about a foot and a half long and appeared to be made of metal and wood. He saw Devadas coming for him, and the look upon his soot-stained face was one of pure terror. Devadas darted between the terrified castlers, rapidly closing the distance. The wizard pointed his device, but Devadas called upon the heart to give him all the speed it could. A terrible roar and shower of orange sparks erupted from the wizard's device as he felt something hot move past his cheek. Immediately behind him, a castless woman was knocked off her feet. The magic must generate a great deal of force because the device was lifted high, nearly torn from the wizard's grasp, but he managed to bring it back down. It had produced even more of the odd white smoke. The lawbreaker reached for something tied to his waist. The horn of a bull. But whatever evil magic he intended to work with it, he never had the chance. Devadas's sword was forward, curving in the southern style, made for removing limbs. He stepped through the haze and struck. The device went bouncing across the dirt, along with the wizard's hand. Devadas kicked the wizard in the chest, launching him back 10 feet. He landed on his back and slid away. As he moved forward to finish the job, Devadas saw that this was no powerful wizard. He was filthy, terribly thin, and dressed in rags like the rest of the non-people. The kick had broken multiple ribs, so he let out an agonized wail. The wail became even more pathetic when he realized his hand was missing, and began thrashing around, trying in vain to stop the gushing of his stump. The other two protectors caught up a breath later. Behind them was a pile of dying rebels who'd been foolish enough to get in their way.
"Secure the prisoner. Tie off his arm so he doesn't bleed out. I want this one alive."
Furious, Devadas walked to the device and picked it up. He had to shake it until the severed hand fell off. It was a curious thing. Steel, with bits of moving brass on it, far heavier than it looked, and the metal part he was holding was hot to the touch. It didn't seem so dangerous up close. But then he looked back toward the castless woman who had been struck by it instead of him. It had blown a hole clear through her guts. It was a ghastly and fatal injury. She may have only been a non-person, but Jamari bent down and quickly cut her throat anyway, mercifully ending her screaming. They walked out of the burning quarter, Devadas with the killing device, and his men carrying their would-be wizard. Around them, the slaughter resumed. Now that the warriors knew there had been deadly fortress magic hidden here, their savagery increased. Not that there had been much mercy given before, but it was an impossibility now. Warriors who had trained their whole lives were especially offended by magic which could make pathetic non-people their equals in combat.
Torture what you can out of him. I want to know where the rebels hide, and I want to know where he got this thing. I'll be along shortly."
Devadas stopped and knelt by Abhishek's body. He'd been a good man, reliable, and a loyal servant to the law. They'd just spent months cold and hungry together, and it was easy to become fond of someone who suffered beside you. Now he'd have to strip him of his valuable armor and arrange for the locals to deal with his corpse. They had an incredibly dangerous job, and it was rare for one of them to live long enough to complete their entire obligation and return to their house, yet every single death under his command seemed a great personal offense. First Ishan, and now Abhishek. There would surely be many more to come. That thought pained him. For though Devadas was an ambitious man, he was not a disloyal one.
"Forgive me, Abhishek. I didn't expect this. You deserved a better death." Talking to the dead was absurd. The law declared there was nothing beyond this. Their lives were a temporary spark clad in flesh and bone, and when it was gone, that was all. Devadas reached down and closed the dead protector's eyes anyway.
As he walked away from the massacre, Devadas held the strange device up to the sun to study it. From the soot around the metal parts, it was obvious which was the dangerous end. It even had a strange and distinct smell, a mix of sulfur, charcoal, and urine. A protector had sensors which allowed them to see arrows coming and the reflexes to dodge out of the way. Even as fearsome a combatant as Abhishek was, he'd never even had a chance against this thing. If the castles in this province had many more of these hidden, things could turn very ugly very quickly.
"Pardon me, Lord Protector Devadas, is that you?"
He turned to see the snarling face of the law and growled at the Inquisitor's mask.
"What do you want?"
The last thing he wanted to deal with right now was the Inquisition.
"I was just informed of your arrival," the Inquisitor said. "I've been ordered to observe this poltron as they participate in the test in order to write a report about the results for the capital."
He didn't know this Inquisitor from any of the others, but he felt like he understood everyone in his rival order well enough. They were malicious, sneaky liars without honor, the lot of them. The Inquisitor had even worn his fine metal mask, usually reserved for holidays and important events, instead of the more practical and comfortable cloth kind they were issued. He supposed, in a way, today probably was a holiday for them. "You can tell your master, Omand, that once the castlers who escape across the river into Dev or across the mountains into Thau tell the rest about this bloodbath, word will spread until every non-person in the world decides they have nothing left to lose. When they panic and rise up against their overseers, he's sure to get that crisis he wants." The Inquisitor gave him a small bow. "Another northerner, then."
"I don't know what you speak of, but I will be sure to record your opinions on the matter and pass them on."
Then he nodded toward the device in Devadas's hands.
"If I may see that, please."
"It killed one of my men."
"My apologies, my Lord Protector, but the law is clear in such things. Seized illegal magic, especially items believed to have originated from the island of Fortress, are to be turned over to the Inquisition as soon as possible."
He held out one hand expectantly.
"I will have it rushed back to the dome for study immediately."
Devadas mulled over just killing the annoying man where he stood. That would be one way to end his report to the judges. But he was correct. The law was clear. And more importantly, Devadas had made an arrangement with the Grand Inquisitor that greatly benefited them both. It would be unwise to jeopardize it over something so petty.
"Take it."
He smacked the mysterious weapon hard against the Inquisitor's open palm. "And hope these rebels don't have too many more of these."
"That is doubtful, Lord Protector. fortress seems to like annoying us by letting some of their craft out into the law-abiding world. But they are too insular, too isolated, and the rebellion too poor to actively trade.
He took the device by the wooden handle. His eyes could be seen through the holes in his mask, and he seemed impressed by the thing.
We've found these before, but never one so compact. This would be easy for a rebel to conceal. Now, may I ask what brings you all the way out here?
It is none of your concern. I have other protectors already on assignment in this region. Do you know their current location?
I do not. I can send for...
That will not be necessary. Devadas began walking away.
May I inquire if you are here searching for Ashok Vidal?
Devadas didn't bother to answer. He knew his former brother better than anyone else alive. From what he'd seen today, if Ashok had truly joined with the rebellion, he wouldn't allow this carnage to continue unopposed. Anything Ashok considered a crime, he would be compelled to stop. The object of his devotion might have changed, but Ashok never would.
The Inquisitor called after him.
Ashok Vidal hasn't been seen for months. He could be hundreds of miles away.
It wouldn't matter if it was 1,000. Devadas knew that Ashok would be drawn here soon enough.
Chapter 4. The wild men of the swamp marked the end of the year with a vast bonfire. As spring had drawn near, every member of the tribe had constructed for themselves a little doll out of hide, sticks, and vines. Each doll was given a name, like Returned from the Hunt Without a Kill, or Fell Asleep on Watch, or Failed to Tend the Crop. Then, on the night they called Dahan, the entire village took turns tossing their dolls into the great fire. Together they watched their guilt and failings blacken and twist into ash. The many other lands that Ashok Vidal had visited had all celebrated the arrival of spring with festivals of colour, singing and dancing, feasting and drinking. But this outcast tribe kept their own odd tradition, which they claimed was based on a ceremony that predated the Age of Law. Religious rites were forbidden. Such a brazen display of law-breaking would have angered him a year ago. But since this isolated people had scraped out an existence in the unforgiving swamps of Bajangal, where demons prowled the fog only a few miles from the shores of hell, the bonfire seemed appropriate. It made a certain sense that a grim people would hold a grim celebration.
"Where's your doll, Ashok?"
Thera asked, as the two of them watched the spectacle from a polite distance away. "If anyone has some sins to get rid of, surely it's you." There weren't sticks and vines sufficient in the world to build a doll big enough to absorb all his transgressions, nor a fire hot enough to burn them away. He would have to build an army of sin-takers and give them names like Castless, who unwittingly claimed honours beyond his station, and Murderer of Honourable Men. Yet Ashok could never give up those burdens. He'd own them until death, because forgiveness was a myth. However, the two of them had many conversations while wintering here, so he knew Thera meant no offence. Blunt and abrasive speech was simply her nature.
"I have no use for foolish superstitions. Where is yours, Thera?"
"I'm a criminal. What would I know about guilt? It's you law-abiding types who are constantly plagued with it, not me."
"Guilt is the natural result of violating the law. It is a warning that we have strayed from our place."
"You keep telling yourself that, Ashok. Most of the law is just smug proclamations from men who think they're better than everyone else. You often still sound as much the religious fanatic as Keita, only your god is made of paper."
"And yours is made of glowing noise."
She snorted.
"Fair."
Though one of the old forgotten gods had chosen her to be his prophet,
Thera wasn't particularly devout. In fact, she didn't care for her god at all. It was an odd combination. Regardless, these folk seemed to take some comfort and strength from the spectacle. The tribe of swamp dwellers had pledged themselves to Thera and joined her rebellion. They will need to be strong, yet they've managed to survive in this inhospitable place, trapped between wizards and demons for a very long time. However illegal their customs, I cannot deny their effectiveness.
Maybe I should have made it, Dol.
A deep melancholy grew in Thera's voice, and he suspected she'd have named hers, led many fools to their demise. But I don't think I could have stitched one together with these hands. Ashok glanced over. She had her arms crossed and her hands tucked inside her coat. Most people would have taken her stance to mean that she was simply chilled and trying to keep her extremities warm. A reasonable assumption, given that even at the edge of spring, this place was still wretchedly damp, and they were too far away to receive any warmth from the bonfire. But Ashok knew that stance had become a habit for Thera, so she could hide her damaged hands from view. He struggled with the concept of kindness, but never with honesty. Severe burns take a long time to heal, and then rarely heal completely. You've recovered far better than I expected when I first saw your injuries. Wielding the Forgotten's magic charge your palm so badly, you are fortunate your fingers still work at all.
Yeah, lucky me.
They went back to watching the ceremony in silence. The villagers had painted their faces, but unlike the bright and colourful festivals in the rest of Lok, the only pigments available were black, white, and the greys in between. Their clothing was dark furs and tattered weavings, better to blend in with the hanging moss of their decaying swamp. They played simple instruments, drums and flutes, as the tribe's headman, Toramana, called each of his people forward to burn what troubled them. Ashok took notice that while most of his troops were watching from the sides as he was, a few of the Sons of the Black Sword had joined in with the villagers and made their own sin dolls. The Somsak especially seemed to have an affinity to the wild men. One group was from the mountains, and the other the swamp, but both were barbaric in their nature. In this place, the Somsak had found a kinship. Perhaps long ago their houses had been distant cousins. On the other hand, the Sons of the Black Sword, who hailed from the great houses of Thau, Karsawan, and Akershan, seemed to be uncomfortable with the whole thing. They came from lands where an open show of faith in illegal gods would bring a swift death sentence from the Inquisitors, or Ashok's old order. So they were used to practicing their beliefs in secret, not with giant pillars of fire. Their prayers were whispers, not beaten on drums. You know, I think Toramana is telling the truth, and this ceremony really did come from the Forgotten back in the old days. Thera muttered. Ashok looked toward her again, but her face was lost in the shadows beneath her hood. Why do you say that?
It's his style. I was a vessel for his failures, and then he threw me in a fire to burn up.
She pulled her hands from her coat, slowly unclenched her fists, and stared at her scarred palms.
I'm merely the doll.
He had no response for that. Once the last of the hideous dolls had been consumed, Toramana raised his voice and addressed the village. Of great stature and physically powerful, he was used to giving commands. The headman spoke from the chest, loud enough so that even their guests standing at the periphery could hear him clearly.
Into this fire we have fed all the evil things which have collected in our hearts. This is a new beginning. Let the smoke rise to the gods above, to the mansion in Upagraha,
as our spirits shall rise when our bodies return to the mud, so that they can see we are good. On this holy Dahan, we are especially blessed, for the gods have gone to war.
The wild men gave their victory shout. It was like the barking of the wild dog packs which prowled their swamp.
Toramana waited until the sound died down. When there was only the crackling of flames, the headman began again.
The Mother of Dawn told us the servants of the old gods would come to us and kill the great evil within the graveyard of demons. They drove the wizards from our land and destroyed the assassin's house. Tonight, the people of the woods are one with the sons of the Black Sword. Tomorrow we will travel to the secret kingdom spoken of by the prophet Thera, a paradise where water is pure and food plentiful, where there are no castes, where the people rule themselves and are not slaves to the capital.
Ashok stiffened at the cheering that brought about. Though he'd become an enemy to the law, his conditioning still made him ache to see such division. These people were descended from the refugees of a house the capital had scrubbed from existence. For that, they still held an animosity that burned hotter than their bonfire. They'd been joined over the years by captives who'd escaped from the House of Assassins. Those captives had come from all across Locke. But they'd been stolen from their homes as children, so they retained no real memory of the law. To this tribe, the law was distant and abstract, but every bit as despised as the wizards who had tormented them. Thera must have mistaken what Ashok's reaction was about, because she whispered,
"Paradise is an exaggeration, but the rebellion's hideout in Akashan is much nicer than this demon-infested mud pit."
But the blighted status of their home was exactly why these people's hatred of the law still burned hot. Over the last few months, he'd explored the flooded forest and seen the partially sunken ruins for himself. House Charsada had once been a marvel. The wild men knew that their ancestors had lived in splendor, but because they had been condemned for the transgressions of men who had been dead for a century, the law still forced them to hide in squalor.
"Blessed are the people of the woods, for we are the ones who gave shelter to the Forgotten's prophet. We are the ones who dug the Forgotten's warrior from the rubble that would have been his tomb. We are the ones who fed the Forgotten's servants while they were ill. And now, we are blessed to join them in this great war, this holy war."
Ashok whispered to Thera, "Once we march these people to your hideout, you, Keeta, and the voice in your head should forget all this talk of war."
"I'd be happy for them to just farm in peace for the rest of their lives, but that's up to the capital now, isn't it?"
Sadly, Ashok knew she was right.
"Powerful is the god who made the trees and the rocks. Powerful is the god who gave us the rivers and the cows. Tomorrow is a new year, and a new beginning for our people."
Even though they were standing in the shadows, Toramana somehow knew where they were, and he looked right at Thera.
The headman made a great display of going to his knees and slapping both his hands against his chest.
"O prophet of the Forgotten, accept these humble servants. We've prepared ourselves since the Mother of Dawn gave us the prophecy. With arrow and spear we will serve you. Our lives belong to the Forgotten."
Thera sighed. They'd already negotiated this all out in advance when Toramana had started pestering her about his tribe joining the Sons of the Black Sword a month ago. There had been logistics to work out. You can't just pack up an entire village, cross the mighty Nansaka, and then walk across the Akashan Plains on a whim. All the real decisions had already been made. This part was a show for Toramana's people.
"I accept these brave servants.
Thera declared, acting far more formal than was her regular, rough manner.
I humbly thank you for taking us in this winter. We've eaten your food, shared your fire, and you've given us a place to heal from our wounds. This kindness will always be remembered. Together, we will bring freedom to all the people of Lok.
Ashok found her diplomatic reply ironic.
Now which of us sounds like Keeta?
The prophet has spoken. We shall journey to paradise, where the keeper of names shall add all of us to the great book.
The tribe barked and howled and pounded away on their drums.
This wasn't just another new year. Tomorrow was a new adventure. A great journey into the unknown.
Ashok suspected that once the full might of the capital was turned against their little rebellion, these people would wish that they'd stayed hidden in their swamp.
All of this carrying on, and it wasn't even really the new year yet.
In the rest of Lok, that was still a week away. Only the wild men didn't follow the standardized calendar mandated by the capital. They declared it spring based upon when certain types of local flowers bloomed. Way out here, it was almost like the law had never existed at all. They watched the party for a time. The sons who hadn't participated in the ceremony had no qualms about drinking the village's alcohol or dancing with their women. Hopefully, no jealous swamp man would start a knife fight with a son for fancying the wrong one. So far, that had not been an issue, because life was so dangerous for the hunters, there were more females than males in the village.
We've got a long journey ahead of us tomorrow.
Thera sounded weary, but becoming responsible for the safety of a large number of people had that effect. Or at least, it did on any leader with a conscience.
I'm going to sleep.
She began walking away, but then she paused and looked back toward him as if she wanted to say something else.
Thera was just a shadow in front of the fire, but somehow Ashok could tell what was going through her head. A terrible burden had been placed upon her. She was afraid, and worse, alone.
Tonight, she didn't want to be alone. Good night, Thera.
She gave him a polite nod.
Good night, Ashok.
Then she walked away.
He watched her go.
The village children ran up to Thera and surrounded her, laughing and giggling, broad smiles on their white-painted faces. At first, they'd feared her, because their parents had warned them that the very voice of the gods was their guest. But she treated the little ones with a gentle kindness the entire time they'd been here, an attitude totally different than the abrasive one she used on adults. So now the children loved her. To them, Thera was a marvel of the outside world. Ashok noticed that with them, she didn't try to hide her hands, and she patted each on the head as she passed by. Despite being a criminal, Thera was as brave as anyone from the warrior caste, and cunning as an inquisitor. Over the last few months, he'd watched her as she'd healed. That recovery had been a grueling ordeal. Every day for weeks, as the village women rewrapped her bandages, they'd come away covered in blood and blackened skin. But she'd faced it with stoicism worthy of a protector. By a miracle in this damp place, they had avoided infection, and her palms and fingertips had eventually healed to angry red scar tissue. Once Thera could grasp something without too much pain, she'd immediately gone back to practicing throwing knives. She'd mastered the skill growing up among the proud warriors of Vayne, who were widely considered to have the keenest eyes and best throwing arms in all of Lok, and been furious when her partially deadened fingers had proven clumsy and near useless for that task. Yet every sunrise since, she'd been out there futilely hurling knives at the same stump. He found such stubborn determination intriguing. If life had been different, and he'd not secretly been born castless, and she'd not been chosen by an illegal god to be its voice, Ashok would have been honored to have his arranged marriage be to someone like Thera.
What in the oceans is wrong with you?
What?
Ashok turned to see Jagdish approach.
You see the way she looks at you.
The Rizaldar had obviously been drinking his way through the celebration. Normally, their officer would not set a bad example in front of the men, but the drink the wild men made from fermented potatoes was incredibly potent, so it didn't take much to leave one a little too talkative.
I didn't know protectors took a vow of chastity.
First, the Protector Order does not have such a rule. Protectors may not wed until after their obligation has been fulfilled, but the service of pleasure women are allowed. And second, I'm not a protector anymore.
So as I said, what the hell is wrong with you? Aside from some mystical gods living inside her head, that's a fine and lonely woman.
Ashok couldn't deny that the thought had crossed his mind with increasing regularity over the long winter. As Thera had recovered, she'd become impatient with hiding. Despite the wild men's protestations that it wasn't safe, she'd demanded to get out of the village. Not being able to draw back a bowstring, she couldn't hunt, but she could forage like everyone else. Of course, Ashok had insisted that he would be her bodyguard during such ventures. Since they were worried about attracting demons, foragers seldom spoke to each other, so they had spent many silent hours together. It was odd, but spending all that time together, digging up roots, he'd been content.
Ashok was not used to such things. I am obligated to serve her. To form such a bond would be inappropriate.
Jagdish laughed at him.
You're the most wanted criminal in the world. That's pretty bloody inappropriate already. And despite you being such an ass toward her, how much have you drank? Not near enough.
Let me try again. Despite you being so damned awkward and cold toward her, you still crossed half the continent to rescue her from wizards, and even a pragmatic girl appreciates such a gesture. Especially one who grew up a warrior. That is not... I'm not done!
Jagdish was one of the only people in Lok who could cut Ashok Vadol off and get away with it.
Such were the indignities of friendship.
Then the whole time we've been hiding in this awful place.
He gestured theatrically around the small village.
You've been damn near the only person she's confided in.
That was because Ashok had demonstrated beyond any doubt that his vow to serve her was sincere. Most everyone else here either worshipped or feared her, whereas Ashok had only ever worshipped the law and feared nothing. He had simply treated her with the respect that she had earned by her deeds.
I suspect she enjoys my company because we are both anomalies in the law-abiding world. Yet Thera is my master. I'm sworn to serve her.
And you're plenty bitter about that, Jagdish snapped. Oh, don't deny it. You know I'm right. You won't say a word about what your mysterious vow's about.
But I was the one who delivered those high-status men and the Grand Inquisitor himself to your prison cell before you all of a sudden went from eagerly awaiting your execution to running off to join a rebellion. Just because I'm warrior caste doesn't mean I'm stupid. Of course not.
The last thing he needed was for Jagdish to take offence.
I will not argue for or against your conclusion.